Welcome back, folks, to episode 50 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast with me, your host, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. And what I'd like to discuss today has to do with our feelings, our affect, and those things that we subconsciously take in that may trigger our emotional responses that have to do with fear, disgust, fight, flight, this sort of thing, and how to recognize these things early so we can help regulate what goes on, whatever our feelings tend to want to get out of hand. Now, the first thing I'm going to identify is that there have been quite a number of studies on our amygdala and how that plays a role in our fear responses whenever we're reactive and whenever we're under stress and anxious and panicky or in full fear, fight, flight, fight for your life response. Now, what I want to indicate is that we all have this, and the structure tends to become a little larger whenever we have a great deal of stress or pain or fear, trauma, this sort of thing occurring in a life. But even whenever somebody is not under extremes of stress or trauma, our amygdala is still there to make sense of the signals that have to do with approach, avoid, our hedonic response about, is that good for me? Does it taste good? Does it smell good? Can I eat it? Or can I mate with it? Or worse yet, maybe I have to fight with it or I have to run because that's not the fight for me. Now, these signals get deliberated upon, so to speak, but not in a rational sense, but rather in a determination of organismic survival. Is this going to help me live longer into the next right now or not? And these things happen very quickly as far as the decisions being made. And one of the things we have to identify about the amygdala is not just about fear, but rather determining whether or not it's something that will be a payoff, survival payoff, that will get us a little further forward in the survival game, so to speak. And also whether or not we need to make haste, make run, and make distance so that we can survive and fight and eat another day, so to speak. So the important part about what we're going to discuss today has to do with the neural inputs, the information that we take in from our perceptions that are unconscious. Often we take in a lot of information that is not interpreted with our conscious mind that we can say, okay, that color, that edge, that shape, and that facial expression is something that's dangerous or good for me. Many things we take in, even having to do with things that are in our periphery or in motion that we're not consciously thinking about. And even if you might be a very detail-oriented person, there's a lot of information moment to moment that you perceive but don't consciously make sense of and organize and therefore respond or react to in a conscious sense. So there's so much information that we do take in that is conscious, and they say that it's about 300 bits of information per second versus 3 million that is taken in, that is assimilated and determined to be useful at some point and put in our memory bank, so to speak, but at an unconscious. The reason this is important is that they've done studies on people that have actually been congenitally blind or have been sighted and lost their sight at a later age, so they've had some visual experience, so they have some memory as to what things may have looked like, this sort of thing. But initially, they had sight and lost it due to injury, and those that are congenitally blind, those that have never been sighted whenever they were born, have been tested. And what is unusual is that in both groups that there are some that have been able to report recognition of shape, and at the very least, motion in certain places, even though they couldn't consciously say, I know what I'm looking at, but they could point in the area where they felt or gut felt that there was something moving or what they would perceive as motion. But without visual acuity, without the rods and the cones firing and interpreting light and making signals, so to speak, that we could consciously say, I can recognize. And the reason this is important is that even in those that had blind sight, those that could identify motion, even with limited blind sight and couldn't identify shapes, but could pick at the very least motion out of their field of so-called vision, even though they weren't sighted, so to speak, but what would be considered the visual field, they would be able to point at it. They were still able to respond to things that may have had an angry or what would be considered an ugly expression, if it were a face, they might not be able to recognize the face, or that they were even looking at a face, or even the shape of the head, so to speak, but they were able to respond and interpret that in unusual or gut feelings that felt uncomfortable. So to make the point is that often whenever we have emotional load, sometimes we may not have a conscious reason that we can attend to and say, okay, that's what it was. We might, but often there are times that we have feelings that pop up, especially if you've ever been hurt or you've had trauma or anxiety, panic, or anything like that, that makes us a little hypersensitive to our environment. And we take in bits of information that could possibly be interpreted as similar, and therefore causing us to react and maybe even over-respond to certain things that otherwise would not be considered dangerous to us. Now, very realistically, the question would be is if I were teaching self-regulation skills to somebody that had this type of reactivity, would be, well, if it's unconscious, that means I'm not aware of it. How can I control it? And I would say, fair enough. That is a great question, by the way. But fact of the matter is, if someone is seeking to learn how to recognize and manage something, that means that they've seen it before. If you've had an experience of it before that you're having emotional reactivity, and sometimes you don't know why it pops up, but you know how it feels and when it occurs, that goes a long way in being able to narrow down when those occurrences happen, and you can zero in on those opportunities to change environment and also possibly limit how reactive one becomes just by being aware of how and when it happened. And by going backwards, not determining the why will come, but the when does it happen? How does it happen? When does this emotional hit me? Where does it occur? How often does it happen? These questions are the practical questions that will give us the facts that we need to determine, well, can I get to the point where I can control and regulate this? And the fact of the matter is that, yes, you can. And if you had the experience once and you can identify it, that means that if you've had it once, at the very least, more likely you've had it more than a few times. And it's familiar. And that familiarity actually can help us develop a plan to learn how to self-regulate, learn to realize what the symptoms of that self-dysregulation feels like when it starts to occur, the increased heart rate, the increased breathing, the body temperature, the narrowing of the vision, wherever things start sounding really far away, maybe even muffled. And note that whenever maybe our voice starts to raise because we can't modulate now because I can't hear as well. And also wherever I might start getting a little confused and start having eyes darting around because my vision was narrowing and I might feel like people are looking at me and I might feel self-conscious. These are some of the symptomology of stress increasing, also anxiety when it's starting to come in. And whenever we're in fight flight, it's very similar, just at a more intense level, of course. And we might also note that we feel a little distance from people because we can't interpret the facial expressions anymore. We become a little numb to it and we start feeling like it's us versus them because we're not getting that little oxytocin payoff that says, hey, friend, befriend, and also bond. And when that happens, it takes a little while once the stress is over for us to be able to gather ourselves and be able to connect with people again. But this is our safety, self organismic survival sense. It's that alarm reaction that says, protect me, save me, and run if you must, fight if you have to. And it's an uncomfortable feeling. Now, knowing how it's coming up is really important. That's one of the first tools in learning how to self-regulate, recognizing environment. Where is it that this occurs most so I can hopefully avoid those things? Sometimes there's family involved, or I have to be somewhere like work and I have to kind of grit through it, then that catch-22 of obligation makes it a little difficult and stressful, which means I'm going to be kind of packing things down and learning how to manage that stress while I'm there, minimizing the symptoms by learning the breathing tools that we talked about, the four-count breath and the double exhale that Dr. Huberman talks about as well, to be able to use those tools when it's happening. The only way those things don't work is if you don't do them. Now, what I'm going to add here is going to be a shifting in gears a little bit, but still relative to self-regulation, but our ability to learn is impacted. Our ability to remember is impacted when our stress goes up. And what we're going to talk about is the educational system, the way it is in the United States, is taught in a manner that people assume that there is a singular learning style where you sit and somebody presents visually while giving you instructions verbally, while you're physically writing notes down, this sort of stuff, or doing math, this sort of thing. But the idea is that we are rationally accessing the higher part of the brain, and we're doing what is called chunk down learning. Whenever you're learning in smaller chunks and bits and pieces, you're learning things stepwise. And this is a wonderful tool for learning how to do things in detail and stepwise in order and correctly, whether it be spelling, mathematics, or even in primary school, learning how to take turns and wait in line. Simple things. Now, whenever we're at our most creative, and also when we're at our most stressful, we tend to look at things as holes. And when I talk about holes, we're talking about what Ken Wilber called holons, seeing everything as a connected singular piece, so to speak, the way we perceive it and conceive it. And this is also another learning style, by the way, that's called chunking down. Whenever you chunk up, you're actually looking at things as a whole. When you chunk down, you look at things as elemental pieces, like the bricks within the wall. Whereas if you chunk up in the way you learn, you look at the whole wall. And the closer you get, the more the details come out. And there are things that can be done along the lines of learning physical skills by copying. And over time, you start chunking down and learning the little details about timing and body position and hand placement if you're doing basketball, baseball, football, anything like that. And then you start gaining those little details over time. You follow along, and then over time you start getting the little nuances and details. Whereas if you chunk up into larger pieces, you realize that you have the fundamental pieces from the chunking down that you may have gotten from the traditional schooling methodology that shows you the stepwise. And it's a little slower, but you do get it and you get all the details, and it's really good to have that. But the chunk up, wherever you're getting the hole, is very much a useful survival tool as well. Whenever you see things on the move really fast and you don't have time to get into details, but at the very least recognize, well, how important is this to me? Is it dangerous to me? Is it something that I can work with? And if it's a skill that I'm learning, can I emulate it? Can I follow it? And often we will do things trying to get the essence or sense of it. And once we slow it down, we start naturally gravitating towards the chunking down into the smaller pieces. But these are two complementary halves of what I would call a complete learning method. And even though the primary school systems here in the United States do lean towards chunking down and teaching the bits, the pieces, and the elements till one gets more skillful and memorizes these things academically, it's a useful tool in learning the things that we want to learn. If you want to do mechanics, you have to learn systems, and you have to learn what those bits of those systems do, and also how they work with a greater whole, and move in towards that bigger picture, the functioning vehicle, if you will. But both, once again, are pieces of the same whole, and I think a more functional whole, if you know how to move back and forth between those two. Now, the reason I mention this is that whenever we're learning how to self-regulate, that means we're gaining skill. We're learning a skill. There's certain steps involved in it. That is why I like to teach the physiology of the stress response, or the human stress model, or the running man model, so to speak, kind of like on the thumbnail on my podcast. But the reason I teach that is if we start getting those bits and pieces, everything starts making better sense. Oh, yeah, I do have trouble breathing when I'm under stress. Yeah, I feel my heart pounding whenever I have a panic attack. Well, when I'm frightened, yes, I have trouble hearing things, and it sounds like things are really faint or muffled, and I can't hear clearly. Or I feel like people are looking at me, and it looks like I can only see out the end of a coffee can, so to speak, when my vision narrows. So those are chunking down the experience of having those negative stress responses in the body. Whereas if we look at it from the perspective of it's unmanageable, this is too big, it's too much for me, it's the hole on, or the larger chunked up version of how I explain things, and we start recognizing that even our language starts to reflect the chunk up dynamic wherever we speak in absolutes, in levels of understanding that are too big for us to handle, in their concepts, yes, but it also takes what's physically happening and puts it in concept out of our hands or out of the realm of control. And we tend to believe it that way. So we develop beliefs as a result of how we see. Now, this is really important to know in that I can change that. And whenever you realize that the symptoms of stress are not singular bits, but rather this whole synergetic effect that our body is going through to get our body out of an area of danger, even in our modern times when we're at work, whenever we're working with others, and maybe in a crowd and this sort of thing, and maybe there's not a saber-toothed tiger trying to eat us, but we still feel like the bologna sandwich under stress. We still feel like we're going to get hurt or damaged. And even though we consciously, reasonably, and rationally know no one's going to do that, the body's responding as if because it's stress, and it responds to stress in two very simple ways: fight, flee, or approach. The fleeing's the avoidance, and the approach means it's either friendly or I can eat it, or we can friend and befriend and eat together, this sort of thing. So it's a very simple thing. It's not particularly driven by the social, but rather by the reactive, organismic response in my environment. And it precedes what we would call the rules or guidelines of social behavior. And even though it is there and it can change and very quickly, suddenly change into fight flight, even within a very peaceful social environment that is pro-social and also very safe and generative, those things can change very quickly. And it's almost like we're always waiting for the other shoe to drop if we've ever had stress or trauma or fear or anything happen. Whenever things suddenly became a maelstrom of pain or discomfort or fear. Whenever before, maybe we were just hanging around having a barbecue with family together. And even the term family does not guarantee absolute perfection, safety, and comfort from danger or anything that would be interloping that could be dangerous to an individual. So we start to question not only the words that we speak about our comforts, family, our safe zone, our home, but also work and the people we work with. You can trust them, but only to a point. And then whenever you're out and about, well, there can be anyone out here, and they could just sneak out and hurt me. They could jump out from the corner or behind the shopping basket and hit me with a cucumber or something. You know, you never know. It could be anything random. And you see where the gradation of perspective is going towards the dangerous and the more dangerous over time in the way I was describing it. And this is kind of how it is. But underlying all those potential factors that we just discussed, those are still social. They still have that underlying quality of that hidden fight flight and that measure of discomfort and maybe anxiety and panic that could be on the edge of occurring. And we may even be squashing it back a bit. If it does become particularly overwhelming, what do? We become very avoidant. We tend to avoid interactions with other people. We may even avoid going to the grocery store. Too many people there, too noisy, too much activity. I've heard it described as being like an anthill, just chaos, and there's no orderliness. If anyone's ever been incarcerated before, and you know, being in the military and being incarcerated, there's constant that you can always count on. And that is, you know, when the head count is, when people are going to sleep, where they are in bed, and what areas you know that people are going to be. And whenever you get out, and civilian life is a bit different, people are pretty much motivated by their own thing, and everyone is individually going about their business. There is some order, like if you see people driving up and down the street, there are certain laws that you got to follow, stoplights and go lights, all this good stuff. And whenever we're out and about after being in such a structured environment. And I experienced this whenever I got out of the military. I noted that people were just running around what I would call willy-nilly, and it took a bit of getting used to. Now, whenever we get very stressed or have been hurt or have some sort of fear or trauma history, everything becomes very uncontrolled, and it seems uncontrollable, chaotic, and out of your control for sure. Which makes us feel very fearful because we can't count on what's going to happen next. And if that heart rate goes up and that breathing changes to where we feel like we're almost exercising sitting down, then it's probably better that we learn how to manage that versus just suck it up and hope to to be able to make it through this next experience, unfortunately. Sometimes we have families that rely on us and we have to go get groceries. Sometimes we may go and get a few things, but not everything that we need, because it would take too long and the stress would be too high. And we have trouble managing having people too close to us, especially if our arousal levels are too high. So these are some very real things that affect how we look at things and how we learn, but also how our perspective and how we believe things comes from how we tend to look at things as absolutes, larger chunked up holes, versus when we're safer and able to detail and take the pieces out, kind of like bricks in a wall that we may be making or taking apart, versus just seeing it as a continuous whole where it becomes overwhelming and beyond my ability to embrace with my hands or even control conceptually. So these are just some ideas to work with, and I want to touch upon a few things having to do with how deep our emotions run, in the sense that we're very easily affected, even by things that are subconscious, that are truly unconscious at the level of the neural structures that are way before our conscious mind ever gets a handle on it. But just to give you an idea that not everything in your emotional load is your fault, so to speak, but has to do often with what is being interpreted as a potentially dangerous or potentially useful situation. And some of that is so fast that we have no way of being able to determine where it starts. But knowing when it starts and having had a prior experience gives us an edge, in that we know that it's happened before and we know what we're dealing with. So it's not an absolute surprise or start from zero when we start learning how to self-regulate. So that's going to be about it for now. I just want to mention that we are now on YouTube. You can find the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast on YouTube and every place that you get your podcasts. I also want to tell you thank you for your listening time. And please share this podcast with people you think may be able to benefit from that. And also, I just want to let you know, if you'd like to reach out, you can email me at runningmangetskillsproject@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to respond to you. And certainly, I hope that your day is going well on this Monday. And we'll talk soon. Take care. Walk well.